Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After years of court delays, North Carolina photo voter ID laws were put into effect in last November's election. And the requirement for voters to bring a photo ID to the polls was used again in the March primary. Done and done, right? Well, not so fast. This morning, a federal trial over that law will begin. A lawsuit alleges it violates the Voting Rights Act by discriminating disproportionately against Black and Latino voters. Republican lawmakers disagree and insist the law builds public confidence in our elections. WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison is on his way, even as we speak, to Winston-Salem to cover that trial this morning and will join us briefly to give us a preview and to help us examine what a decision in either direction might mean for voters and for democracy. Drs. Michael Bitzer and Susan Roberts are here. Dr. Bitzer is professor of politics and history at Catawba College, and Dr. Roberts is professor of political science at Davidson College. And Mary C. Curtis is also here. She's a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Steve, I know you're on your way to the trial. Don't want to hold you up too much, so I'm starting with you. I want to tell everybody, he's pulled over to the side of the road for this. So, Steve, this trial was originally scheduled in 2021 and again in 2022. In fact, this has been an 11-year struggle to get this underway. Why is this trial just now getting underway, two election cycles into using voter ID?
Well, Mike, we'll back up for a second. Republicans have tried to enact photo ID ever since they took over the General Assembly in 2011. This kind of phase of the battle, so to speak, goes back to 2018 when they placed a constitutional amendment on the ballot that voters approved. So we're kind of in a six-year window trying to get this established. Litigation has gone back and forth for a while. Photo ID was stopped in state court, but then last year, the state Supreme Court, with a new conservative majority, said photo ID was constitutional. This case in federal court has still been winding its way through the system, and this is really kind of the last real impediment or, barrier for photo ID to become, really kind of a consistent law of the land, even though we've already had it in a couple of elections. This is really the final battle, like you said, a multi-year process.
So I guess our state Supreme Court has determined that this is constitutional in terms of the state constitution, but the constitutionality of this is in question at this trial. The suit filed by the NAACP alleges that the law violates the Voting Rights Act, but some say the outcome of this trial will also decide what? The constitutionality of this law in terms of the United States Constitution?
Yeah, the NAACP, who are the plaintiff in this case, like you said, they allege that it violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, as well as the 14th and 15th Amendments. So this is now the battleground, the U.S. Constitution, to see if photo ID meets that standard. And, we will have an answer. This will be a bench trial, no jury. We'll have an answer presumably pretty soon.
This law was put forward by, as you said, by Republicans, and then they put it to a vote of the citizens as a constitutional amendment, and 55%, as you mentioned, of the citizens said yes, they wanted photo ID. Does that say more about people believing that there's nothing wrong with asking for identification at a polling place, or more about the political makeup of the state?
Well, I mean, I think a little bit of both, but when you get to 55% in North Carolina, we're a closely divided state. When you get to 55%, then, you were having a fair number of Democrats who were coming over to your side and who are in favor of photo ID, don't think it's a big deal. I think there are about 35 states in the country now that do require some kind of photo ID. Now, just because, you know, we've got a 55%, it's a pretty sizable margin. That doesn't necessarily mean it's right or it's constitutional, but there was, I think, reasonably broad support to show a photo ID when voting.
And obviously, as we said, it was put forth by Republicans. Democrats have warned many times about dire consequences for putting this into place. And of course, the suit alleges that it disproportionately impacts African Americans and Latino voters. But it's been in place now in the November elections last fall and the March primary this spring. And I'm just curious as to what, if any, problems this requirement caused voters. Has it resulted in some people being wrongfully denied the right to vote?
So in the March primary, we had 1.8 million people vote in North Carolina. At the end of the day, 473 people had their ballots rejected because of the photo ID law. If you look at it from a kind of a 30,000 foot view, that's not a lot of people. That's probably not enough to sway, to move a statewide race one way or the other. Now, if you're one of those 473 people and you came to the polls wanting to vote and wanting to participate, well, that's a pretty big deal, right? I mean, you weren't allowed to, your ballot didn't count. So I think it's a, you know, you can look at it one of two ways. On this individual level, this is it's problematic to not have your vote count. But in terms of moving in November between Biden and Trump, will photo ID be a big factor to swing the race one way or the other? At this point, it doesn't appear that's going to be the case.
Well, you did a deep dive into this and you discovered that 0.03% is what the impact of this was. It means that it did not impact 99.97% of voters, or one in every 3,805 voters. Is that, I mean, yeah, as you say, one person being denied their right to vote is one person too many, but overall the impact is minuscule. It would not have changed the outcome.
Right. And we will see now as we move into November. One thing I think it's important to remember, in the March primary, 1.8 million people voted. That's a lot of people. But the people who vote in primaries tend to be the most engaged, the most kind of educated and familiar with the system. As we go to November, we are going to have more first-time voters come out. So that rate of failure may increase. We may have more people who show up and they just never heard of photo ID. They have no idea what it's about. So we could see more people moving in November. But, you know, as it stands so far between the November municipals and the March primary, we did not see a large number of people who couldn't participate because of the new law.
Mary, I know you wanted to chime in on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I think when you generalize and said it won't make a difference, you have to look at North Carolina, where we are a very tight state, and we have had elections like the state Supreme Court Chief Justice between Sherry Beasley and Paul Newby that were decided in the hundreds of votes. And looking to November, we see both parties, Republicans and Democrats, making a real run at North Carolina. And all down the ballot, there could be some very tough races, close races, that a few hundred would make a difference. And as Steve said, if you are one of these people, it's very important to you. And also you're gonna have many more people come out. Poll workers, I remember at the last election, the primary, I asked one of our workers about, because I was curious, what IDs are acceptable if you don't have the photo ID. And she had to go get a paper and kind of look at it. So this also could actually foment some confusion. And add to that, which we'll talk about later, I think in the hour, you have more poll watchers who might be there questioning certain voters, questioning IDs. So I would say, before brushing it off as saying, well, it's a minuscule, I think we really have to take a deeper dive.
This was put in place by Republicans, and it's happened across the country in other states, mostly in Republican-controlled states. because there are legislators and other Republican leaders who believe, or at least they say they believe, that having a photo voter ID will safeguard election integrity. Given the absence of any meaningful incidents of elections being tainted by voter fraud or election fraud, is there any truth or any validity to those concerns, Steve?
Well, the big, you know, the big data point in North Carolina is from 2016, when the State Board of Elections did an audit on that election. And they found, I believe it was two cases of people impersonating someone else when trying to vote in that presidential election. I think one was a child, their parent had passed away, and they wanted, you know, they wanted their votes to count, et cetera. Two cases out of probably, what, 5 million, 5.5 million votes. So again, hard to see that in-person voter fraud is a problem. It's hard to see that photo ID is fixing any sort of problem. Then the flip side, of course, is Republicans are going to say, look, this is still widely popular. We use IDs for so many other things. Why not use it when voting? But, you know, it's hard to see the big problem that we're trying to fix.
So this trial begins today in just a little short while from now in Winston-Salem in federal court. And as you mentioned, it will be a bench trial, no jury, with I think her name is Loretta Biggs, a U.S. district judge presiding. Why a bench trial? Who made that decision?
That I actually cannot give you the detail on in terms of why, but a lot of the voting cases in North Carolina, whether they're photo ID or over gerrymandering for political maps, tend to be bench trials where a judge or a panel of judges makes the decision.
And who will be arguing for each side?
So for the NAACP, there's a group called Forward Justice. They are representing the plaintiffs, and the North Carolina, the Attorney General's office will be defending this law. The AG's office has not always defended the state, but Josh Stein's office in this case has felt that photo ID is constitutional, and they have defended it all through his tenure.
Last week, a U.S. magistrate judge, Patrick Auld, limited the number of new witnesses and new documents that the plaintiffs could bring to this trial and use. Why and what impact is that likely to have? And why did a magistrate judge make that decision and not the trial judge?
So, yeah, I am not familiar with that particular ruling, and we will see here in a few minutes in terms of what kind of documents are allowed and how much we are going to go in to detail on what happened in March in the primary and the kind of real-time data that we have. So, yeah, I'll have to wait and see.
So I have less than a minute. So a couple of quick-fire questions here. Is this court's decision likely to be appealed no matter what way the decision comes down?
Yeah, I think so. I think almost certainly.
And how long is this bench trial expected to last?
I don't think a particularly huge amount of time, but I think we will be here for several days. So not a one and done on today.
And whether or not this decision is appealed, is it going to affect voter ID, photo voter ID laws nationwide or just in North Carolina?
I believe this would just be North Carolina, and this would not overturn any other state. Even though we're talking about a federal issue, that this would not overturn any other state's requirement.
WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison on his way to that trial in Winston-Salem. We'll let you go. We'll come back with Michael Bitzer, Susan Roberts, and Mary C. Curtis in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the trial that begins today in Winston-Salem that may or may not impact photo voter ID in North Carolina. Suit brought by the NAACP, who says it's unfair and disproportionately affects African-American and Latino voters, and Republicans say it will protect election integrity. Michael Bitzer is with us. He is professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College. And Mary C. Curtis, the columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Michael, this move to require photo ID at the polls is something that we've talked about many times on this program. And certainly this morning you've mentioned that this is a Republican pet project. But why?
Well, I think certainly it plays into the issue that Republicans really focus on, and that is election security, making sure that voters have confidence that there isn't election fraud or voter fraud. North Carolina, along with this lawsuit, has a very clear history. You just have to go back to the North Carolina 9th Congressional District and really talk about as a prime case example of the issue of election fraud.
You're referring to Mark Harris and what happened down there a couple of cycles ago, which was, by the way, election fraud or voter fraud, or I've forgotten which now.
It was election fraud. It was not voter fraud. Voter fraud is when a voter tries to, you know, present themselves or try to game the system. This was election fraud. This was a campaign doing the nefarious misdeeds
that
were called out.
And in that case, it was a Republican campaign or being done on behalf of a Republican campaign. So I guess the question is, clearly this is a pet project for Republicans, but is it ginned up? Is it, given the fact that there's very little, if any, nationally at least, election fraud or voter fraud to point to, is there more to it than meets the eye? That's the question.
Well, I can't speak to individuals' intent and mentality, but I can say that a lot of these, I mean, the 36 states that have adopted these are basically Republican-driven, and it is also a component of, you know, the dynamic to ensure that everybody's vote is properly counted if they are doing what the state requires them to do. And the Supreme Court, in a case coming out of Indiana regarding their photo ID law, said that indeed, if a state has an interest in making sure that there is voter confidence, even with the minuscule, if not zero, issue of voter fraud being happening, they can seek to impose these kinds of regulations on voters casting ballots.
Susan Roberts, and I think Steve brought this up a little while ago, but it's a reasonable question to ask. Is it unreasonable in a world where we are, in fact, asked for our driver's licenses, which have a photo of us on the license, when we book an airplane ticket, when we make other transactions like at banks? Certain transactions at banks require identification. You rent a car, it requires that same identification. Is it unreasonable to ask for photo ID at the polls?
Well, it's not, an election is not decided by renting a car. And I think it is something.
No, but it's decided by people who say that they are who they say they are and who are citizens and who live at the address they say they live at.
I think both my colleagues here would agree. It's the context here in North Carolina, and it's the context that probably really people do in terms of, I think Pew said 95% of the Republicans support voter ID, 69% of the Democrats, but overall the numbers were about equal. It's become something that voters are more familiar with. I think it's, you know, we cannot look at and evaluate intent, just like in plagiarism. We don't know if someone intended to plagiarize. It's very difficult. And we can't really evaluate. There have been studies about impact. And I think in the larger scheme of things, this is a question worth asking, because if it doesn't happen at the polls, how do we measure turnout? What kind of impact on turnout would this have in terms of people feeling as if they know how to vote? And voter, see, in the whole era of people that aren't confident in elections, democracy is on the ballot. So I think that you have to look, North Carolinians, there have been a history of, you know, rehearing this case, and there have been things that are suspect. And I may be talking all the things I was going to talk about later, but we're hyper-polarization, hyper-partisan antipathy. And so I think that it's a context of heightened partisanship and animosity. And I think that has plays into it sometimes. It is, you do have to show an ID for many things. But, proving your residence, taking a water bill or you know power bill. But now with photo ID, it's sometimes difficult for individuals to procure that, well, even though they've made it easy.
Well, is it? Because they have made it easy. Mary, the NAACP and others say this places an undue burden on certain segments of the population, specifically African Americans and Latino voters. But the state did open the door to using different types of voter ID other than just driver's licenses, because not everybody has a driver's license. So why is this discriminatory, given the fact that they have opened the door to other forms of ID that they have tried to make as easy as possible, allegedly, to get?
Well, I think what Susan said was important, the word context and also history. If we look at our history as a country, do we have a true democracy? Could we have said we had it before the 1965 Voting Rights Act? We're pretty much in the South, this region. African Americans were disenfranchised. And ever since that act, you've had people working to chip away at that, including, I might add, one of the early skeptics was now Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, even when he was a law student. And when you say, yes, you have more things acceptable, that makes it more of a hurdle for people like poor people, Black people, Latinos, the elderly. You have to get to those offices to get that those IDs. You have to get that transportation. If you don't have a driver's license, that's more difficult. And the point is, why would you want to put those hurdles in place for people to vote? We have seen since 2013, the Supreme Court, of course, struck down some provisions of the Voting Rights Act. It used to be you had to, for some states that had a history of discrimination, get approval before you even had a change in the voting law. Since they struck that down, you saw immediately these states put these hurdles, these multi-page, very confusing voting laws. As Susan said, you know, maybe some people who were going to vote, they would say, why do I even want to bother when it's this difficult? Yeah. So that is the point. And what you said earlier, it almost seemed like a solution in search of a problem. And didn't we see so much of this activity after 2008 when Barack Obama won North Carolina? And so many people were shocked at that. So look at the context and look at the history.
The Fourth Circuit did say when they struck this down the last time that it was enacted with discriminatory intent, targeting African Americans with almost surgical precision and imposing cures for problems that did not exist. Has anything changed, Mary?
Well, in that case, they left a lot of footprints where you had the emails, they studied how Black and minority voters voted the most, and they went after those. In this case, of course, they don't have those footprints, and they have a very friendly state and Supreme Court. So they would say, yes, things have changed. But I can see where the NAACP and the other plaintiffs are saying, listen, we might not be able to point exactly to the intent in such a clear way, but that intent is still there when you look at it. And the effect of it will be, you know, just sort of shaving off certain votes on the margins. And you've had many Republicans say outright, it's better for them when fewer people vote, which seems to me anti-democratic, but there you go.
Michael Bitzer, Republican state legislative leaders in advance of the trial that begins today have defended the law that we all passed, or that 55% of us said yes to, by submitting a brief to the court reminding them that is exactly what happened, that 55% of voters said yes to a constitutional amendment saying we have to have photo ID at the polls. And they also hold that this is one of the least restrictive voter ID laws in the country, which guarantees all registered voters will be allowed to vote with or without a photo ID, and provides a lengthy list of qualifying IDs that most people use, they say, in their daily lives. I don't know what specifically they're talking about. Maybe you do. Are they wrong? And is this likely to sway the judge? This is a bench trial. The judge will make this decision.
Sure. Well, the acceptable photo IDs that the State Board of Elections has put on their website, certainly a driver's license is probably going to be the paramount one. But you can also use a driver's license or a non-driver ID from other states as long as it's 90 days within an election. You could use a U.S. passport. Granted, not a lot of people have passports. But for folks like college students, a whole host of colleges and community colleges have put forward their IDs as acceptable and seeking approval from the State Board of Elections. Those IDs can also be utilized. And the other issue, and along with counties providing free photo IDs for their residents as well. The one thing that I would also add into, and this was included in the Supreme Court's reasoning of upholding Indiana's photo ID law, was that if a voter comes to a polling place and does not have an ID, they can submit a provisional ballot. Yes, they would have to go back and prove with a photo ID or some kind of documentation that indeed they are who they are and their provisional ballot would be counted. But the court held that those provisional ballots offer a safeguard in order to ensure that it is not a blanket discriminatory effect of I can't vote, therefore I'm being denied the right to vote.
Susan Roberts, how does our law, the one that's in question today in the court, compare to other states' laws that have enshrined voter ID provisions?
Well, as far as I know, there have been more, the other laws have been more, put it in, pass it, go on with it. We have had 5 years or more of confusion. I was walking into the office today and someone said, but I had an ID. I had to have an ID in the primary, in the May election, March, I had to have an ID in November. Why are they still doing this? And I think it's the confusion. I think there's been much more confusion. And Michael can speak to this, if you layer on top of that in North Carolina, and there's no disputing, well, there may be, I'll ask Michael, he wrote the book on it, literally, redistricting in North Carolina and gerrymandering in North Carolina. And so layer that on top of every other question. I don't think we should, have trials and add confusion ad infinitum, but this is one more chance of people saying, okay, give us some evidence, make a convincing case as to whether or not there is an undue impact. And so I think that you put in the gerrymandering, North Carolina is in the forefront of that. And I think that makes it even more, there needs to be more examination, or they won't bother, won't muddy the waters. Just have it out there one more time and then have people look at the headline and say, do I or don't I? And it'll help eliminate some of the confusion.
So, Michael, do you want to jump in there since you wrote the book on this? I mean, do you want to plug your book?
I only wrote a book on redistricting. I didn't write it on voter photo ID. But I will echo what Susan is saying. And the issue is, what are the costs incurred with the right to vote? And I think where the courts struggle with this is the issue of, yes, there is, protections for the most fundamental democratic participatory action, that is casting a ballot and expressing your voice at the ballot box. At the same time, there is also the governmental need to ensure the administration of elections, the security of those ballots, and the confidence in the system. There's a balancing act. And I think that this issue of photo ID is really, indicative of that dynamic that we are all struggling with.
Mary.
And I would say, though, that this whole issue of election integrity was really stoked by the former President Trump, who has been saying since 2020 that he won and that there were problems, there was fraud, there were all kinds of shenanigans, even though, what is it, upward of almost 60 courts have thrown out legal challenges to the results of that. But still, you see him repeating that. And they're saying that if you want to work for him, with him in his campaign, it's almost the litmus test. You have to say that there's something funny going on with elections. So in that case, some of this doubt, we have to say, was stoked by him, by Republicans. And so when people say, well, I'm concerned about election integrity, there really wasn't a concern.
And that continues to be the case because, once again, he's saying that he's hedging on whether he will accept the results of this election. He says it depends on the outcome, meaning if I lose, then it was rigged. WFAE, Mary, analyzed 473 voters whose ballots were rejected in March in the primary and found that Democratic voters and Black voters were slightly more likely to have their ballots rejected. 298 white votes did not count, and 74 Black voters' ballots were rejected. Does that make the NAACP's case or call it into question? Does it make their case, does it help or hurt them?
Well, I would just say, you know, as the panelists have said, this was a primary. In a general election, you're going to have a lot more folks come out and with a lot more questions. And maybe some of these first-time voters, I think they still have a case to prove. But the fact that you can say very few voters, you know, were affected doesn't necessarily mean, well, we don't have to worry about that. And you do have to take the history of this state and its treatment of minority voters into consideration, not just for the government and how they will treat them, but how the voters themselves will feel. Will they feel welcome? Will their votes be welcome? If they are questioned about their qualifications, how will that hit them? Will that discourage them, family members? You know, we saw how in Florida, even after voters overwhelmingly voted to give former felons back the franchise, how Governor DeSantis, Ron DeSantis, had this election integrity task force that went after some of them, and they tried to chip away with it, as if to say, listen, if you do this, there will be consequences. So I can still see where they have a possibility of making their case.
Mary, I have less than a minute, but given the history of Black voters and intimidation of Black voters at the polls, particularly during Jim Crow, are there residual effects of that still at play? And does this bring that back into people's minds? Or has that gone by the wayside and this is just something else that's been added to the burden?
In this era of polarization, this is definitely a case. Also, Republicans just got out of a consent decree that they were under for intimidation at the polls. So,
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast. We're also here with Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, and Michael Bitzer, professor of history and political science at Catawba College. We'll continue this conversation about photo ID, which goes on trial today in Winston-Salem, in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about photo ID requirements in North Carolina and the trial that begins today in the 4th District Court in Winston-Salem that may or may not determine whether we continue with that. With Dr. Michael Bitzer and Dr. Susan Roberts from Catawba College and Davidson College, respectively, and Mary C. Curtis, the columnist for Roll Call. Michael, some have argued that even having one voter's vote rejected because they didn't have a photo ID or a proper ID, sure, whatever, if they're legally allowed to vote and having that vote rejected is one too many. Given all the numbers that we've cited this morning, it doesn't appear that many people have been impacted by this. But does this law make it more likely that some people will be denied their voting rights?
I would presume so. I can't predict into the future. I certainly don't know. I think November here in this state is going to be a great case study for those who study this particular issue, because it's a natural experiment. You know, we have individuals within the 7.4 million registered voters that the State Board of Elections has identified as not having driver's licenses. Now, whether they have them and the records just are not properly updated, we'll just have to wait and see how November comes along. Yes, the issue of having your vote denied based on not having a photo identification to that individual, you know, would speak to volumes in terms of what we are in terms of our self-governance. How we're going to resolve this and whether it's going to be perfect to everybody's taste, I can't make that determination.
So, Susan, following the last presidential election cycle, Donald Trump, the loser in that election, made many, countless, continues to make, as Mary pointed out, assertions that the thing was rigged, and there were abundant examples of election or voter fraud. And many investigations and court decisions say that is simply not true. There was no evidence of that at all in any substantial amounts around the country. But going hand in hand with that evidence that there was no voter fraud, if you are in a state that doesn't require photo ID, how do you know there was no voter?
Well, I think that, again, all those cases and it accumulated that there was no evidence was important. And
but how do you know if I can just walk in to Nebraska during election day and say I live at such and such address because I passed that address on the way into the polling place and they don't ask for photo ID? How do they know I'm not fraudulently voting?
But Mike, they're going to when they look you up in the voter rolls. And you claim an address at 301 North Ellis Street, mm-hmm. and there is no 301 North Ellis Street in Lincoln, Nebraska, there's not going to be a record of you being a registered voter.
But if I go past a mailbox and pull somebody's mail out and get their name and address,
have just committed a federal crime, which
yes,
I would encourage all listeners and you not to do.
I understand that. But what's to say that that doesn't happen? And if you don't have photo ID, how do you know it doesn't happen? That's my question.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's just anything else. If the casting and counting are important. And you're talking about the casting of a ballot. And we've just had study after study after study after study mm-hmm. that really concludes it's rare to have voter fraud. Very rare. Now, sometimes there's election fraud in which, you know, the vote, the canvassing and the harvesting in Bladen County. But also we have, you know, what if an election, a machine breaks down? That would be election fraud. That would be an election violation, not a voter violation. And just like Michael, I don't know how you look for something that is or is not there. I mean, there has to be a certain level, and this is why democracy is on the ballot, a certain level of trust in elections. And that's been eroded since 2020.
Well, then, you can't answer that question, Susan, doesn't this provision to require photo ID lessen the chance of that and, as Republicans argue, increase confidence in our elections?
Well, you're right. I can't answer that in terms of whether or not the fact that I can't prove someone didn't do it, didn't commit some kind of voter fraud. But I think this is an anecdotal experience here in Davidson. I couldn't misrepresent myself because everybody knows everybody. I go to the poll and there's a friend of mine who knows that maybe I thought one day, oh gosh, I hope I've changed my address because I did move from this street to this street.
Yeah.
I just think, I mean, in a way we're built on trust in democracy. And I'm not saying that I don't think photo ID is always a bad thing. I'm just saying, as Mary pointed out, you've got to look at it, the history and the context and the consequences. I'm not, you know, I think that let's look at it again. Let's gather more data. There hasn't been the data that shows voter fraud. And I think Michael would agree with me and Mary would agree with me. I think you would agree with me. We layer on that now the fact that democracy on the ballot in 2022, democracy won. Our measure was simply that the election deniers didn't get elected everywhere they ran. And so that's a low bar.
Yeah, of course.
And even if all these laws in place, Mike, do you think with all these voter laws in place, if Trump did lose in 2024, that he still wouldn't say that there was rampant voter fraud? So, I mean, in a sense, these laws aren't protection against people saying, well, now I think the vote is fair.
Of course, Susan, you mentioned everybody knows you in Davidson when you go to your precinct.
Well,
then
not
to vote.
Everybody, but well, you know, but, Michael Bitzer in Salisbury.
I know that when I voted in my precinct, the poll workers generally knew who I was because I used to vote there all the time. But since I've been early voting, I vote in a different place and they have no clue who I am or where I live. One reason that fewer than 500 people had their ballots rejected in the March primary here in North Carolina, Mary, is that voters can fill out a photo ID exception form, which allows them to check several boxes that give them a reason for not having photo ID, like not having transportation to get that ID, or that they simply lost that ID. And WFAE did some research on this. It shows that roughly 90% of those who filled out that form had their votes counted in March. If that provision stays in place, does that reduce concerns in any way over this policy disenfranchising people?
Well, that is a good provision to have. And as I said, it also depends somewhat on the poll workers, the folks who are there to make sure that people know this. As I said, when I asked, they know me at the polls too. So of course, when I said, I want to see the list, the woman who's very conservative said, I don't want to argue with you, Mary. And I said, I'm not here for an argument. I just want to make sure you have the rules so you can explain to people what to do. So a lot of that depends on that. And I mean, I'm very aware of this. My mother was a longtime poll official in the state of Maryland, a Republican, when there were Republicans, moderate Republicans like Charles Mack Mathias. And this was sort of this sacred duty to do this, to prepare to have a Republican and a Democrat at every poll, to make sure they knew how to answer every voter's questions. And now you have fewer people even wanting to take on those roles because of how much these poll workers have been intimidated. So yes, that is a good provision to have, and you have to have correct and educated staffing at every polling place to make sure that they can explain that to every voter.
So we have these other options, Michael, but outgoing North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore believes the law that we have, as it is presently constituted, presents too many loopholes. He told WRAL television in Raleigh, quote, I think the affidavit where you can simply attest that you don't have it, a photo ID, is silly. It's pointless, he says. You ought to have an ID to vote, and I think we ought to make that abundantly clear. If the court decides in the state's favor in this case that begins today, is the legislature likely to go back and close that loophole and perhaps tighten up other provisions of this law?
I mean, they certainly can. They are in their short session. It would certainly be, I think, within their purview to do so. Whether there's a crossover vehicle by which they can introduce that legislation, I'll leave it to others to make that determination. But, you know, if the legislature gets the approval signed off by this court, you know, as you indicated earlier, there's probably going to be some appeals in this process, all the way up to potentially the U.S. Supreme Court. So, you know, it may be a 50-50 chance of that actually happening, depending on the type of ruling, depending on the appeal and the movement up when we get a final decision on all of this.
Susan, would tightening these loopholes be politically good for Republicans in the legislature, or would it hurt them in the legislature, given that 55% of voters said yes to a constitutional amendment to support photo ID?
Well, I think if you just look at the one thing I thought was striking in 2023, you had a ruling about the voter ID. It was revisited once you had a majority of the Republicans on the North Carolina Supreme Court. And that was pretty rare. And I think that there is a strong association between certain parties and certain, you know, stances on voter ID or voting rights. And I don't know when for years, and I can't give you chapter and verse, the Republicans opposed motor voter, meaning you could register to vote at the DMV. And they opposed it because they thought it might advantage the Democrats. It turned out that it didn't advantage one party over the other. But there have been a history of like really tough fights on voting provisions that have a partisan tint to them.
Well, that brings this up, I suppose, because this voter ID requirement is but one in a series of measures being passed mostly by Republican legislators across the country that appear to infringe or potentially infringe on the right to vote or to limit voting by finding ways to make it more difficult to vote, like limiting voting hours. Having a photo ID requirement in Georgia, you can't give water, as Curb Your Enthusiasm pointed out. You can't give water to people standing in line to vote. Gerrymandering has made voting in some areas almost pointless. Susan, is this all part of a coordinated plan to limit democracy?
I don't think it's a part of a coordinated plan, but I do think, and if there's one thing I want to emphasize, it makes things more confusing. If you look at the voting laws in terms of the kind of accordion, whether you have longer early voting days, shorter ones, there's still a lot of confusion. Where do I go? And just in general, the confusion all across the country is a bad thing. And that has to depress turnout. Laws can affect turnout. And while I don't think it's necessarily something that's driven by any kind of national effort to suppress voting. You look at, say, early voting. Now the Republicans are more in favor of early voting in terms of the RNC because they saw it was pretty healthy for the Democrats. And so there are just a lot of partisan issues surrounding casting a ballot. I wish there weren't. I wish there were fewer. This is only going to add for confusion in North Carolina. In terms of not only just legally, do we have to have it by this date, but the really low trust in democracy, confusion in North Carolina. There are people that didn't know what district they were in after they really said, am I in the 12th district now or who's in the 9th district? And that itself, the redrawing of district lines, adds to a lot of confusion. Yeah. And if there's confusion, people just might not vote. And elections are determined as much by who doesn't turn out. Not as much, but
Michael,
that makes a difference.
Rusty Jacobs, WUNC's voting and elections integrity reporter, says the state's voters have, quote, have adapted to major election law changes like the photo ID requirement and the new deadline for mail-in ballots. He says more than 99% of in-person voters this March showed valid ID when they cast their ballots. If that is accurate, and there is no reason to believe that it is not, does that negate the need for this suit? I mean, some may not like the requirement, but if 99% complied, it doesn't seem like a hardship. Am I reading this wrong?
Is this to me?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sure. I mean, people can look at that and say, you know, the law is working, the voters have adapted themselves, and the process is playing itself out. You know, the question, again, then comes back to who is being impacted potentially disproportionately. The research on these kinds of things within political science is mixed. Some studies find a disproportionate impact on minority voters, on people with lower socioeconomic status, on those that are less engaged in politics versus those that have higher resources and higher capabilities and are engaged in politics. So, you know, this court case, I think the evidence is going to be critical to show what kind of dynamic is being impacted and what will that disproportionality, if any, be on representative groups.
On the other hand, Mary, North Carolina Democratic State Senator Natasha Marcus wanted to know if state election officials had any way of tracking the number of voters who did not even try to cast a ballot because of this requirement. Evidently, that information is difficult to come by. Anecdotally, what, if anything, have you heard?
Well, I just think that if anybody was discouraged, then that's a problem. And you can't really measure that. But it's hard-boiled politics, Mike, when you feel that if you don't have a message that can appeal to the broadest possible group of voters, well, then how can you make sure that your voters are the ones that come out and disproportionately vote for you? And as Susan said, I think that's rather sad in a democracy that instead of trying to get more people to vote for you, you try to get fewer people to vote. And we see that happening all over the country. And I think that's a shame.
Michael, State Senator Paul Newton, a Republican, still points to the need for this law, saying if we don't have integrity in our elections, we don't have anything. But given the absence of any voter or election fraud on any meaningful scale in an American election, is this just politics, a smokescreen, or worse? And I have 10 seconds.
It's politics. Welcome to Politics 2024.
And that's why you're the expert. Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College, Susan Roberts, professor of political science at Davidson College, Mary C. Curtis from rollcall.com. Thank you all for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.